customers, it's actually important to have these early.
It makes it real, right? You're holding something that's tangible, and you're able to visualize it, as you mentioned, online.
Yeah, they can't crack it open, but they can at least hold it. Hello, everyone. You're listening to Making Maca, a podcast about a startup beverage journey into launching and scaling a CPG brand. I'm Brian Hill.
And I'm Russell Hirshon.
And we are your hosts. In this episode, we will be talking about prototypes, creating them, and how to utilize them to make high-impact presentations to prospective investors and retailers. There's nothing better than having final product in hand. Let's just start with that. Most of us at the stage that we're talking about can't afford to do that, though. When you talk about the cost of an initial production run, it's pretty staggering, actually. You have minimum order quantities that you have to deal with. That's minimum order of cans you produce, in our case, minimum order of supplies that you need to bring in. So there's a lot that you need to think through, especially from a cost side, when it comes to weighing out when to do a production run. Because of those costs, we ended up going down a path where we created what I'm calling prototypes. There's another term out there that's a prototype run. That's if you're talking with a co-manufacturer, and they actually create final product in a can. It's very expensive to do that. When you're talking 5 to 10 times the cost per can to do a prototype run than it is to do a minimum order quantity run.
I love the way you say we didn't have them. It was actually you. You're the one that made the prototypes, which is always a fun part of me being able to tell the story, is how you navigated these waters. And upon knowing that you needed prototypes, upon knowing that you needed to raise funds, that you started from scratch.
At the time, I was flying solo and self-funding, so very, very limited on what I could accomplish. And when I was talking about the prototype run, I quickly realized, no, can't do it. Sourcing ingredients, getting the supplies, lining up packaging, you have to get UPCs. That's a whole nother thing. And there's a lot more that goes into it than what I just listed there. Additionally, I wanted this to be organic certified. It's a process to get organic certified. There's a cost to doing that. You also need to go through label review and all these other things just so you're protecting yourself. So it was very clear to me that since all that went into a first production run, it wasn't going to be a viable avenue. One other factor, like we don't necessarily have the issue because we have a longer shelf life than some products. If you have a short shelf life, it's not viable to do a first production run until you know that you either have distribution or a retailer on the hook. Your product could go bad before you even get it in front of someone. So for all these reasons, creating my own prototype, as I'm going to call it throughout the rest of this episode, is the avenue I had to go down.
In the times that I was at your house, there was always multiple levels of creation going on. Things happening in the kitchen, things happening in the basement, things happening in the living room. It was quite a sight to see.
I'll say it now. Sorry, Brittany. Thank you for letting me do that. But it was necessary because I remember vividly when I tried to pitch someone without at least prototype can in hand, I was going in with my plastic sample bottles. And these are like little stubby 12 ounce clear bottles. So the first issue was my product didn't present well because wheatgrass is obviously heavier than the liquid it's sitting in. So it would settle to the bottom. So it looks like this little green, not little, but a pretty thick green layer at the bottom. The fruit juices have separated out. Definitely not appealing.
A tough sell.
Yeah. Yeah. The looks weren't great. And when someone comes in and that's the first thing they see, it's hard to envision what the end product is going to look like, even if you give them like a rendering on a computer or you print something off. So that's when I realized they needed something physical to hold while they were sampling so they could envision, okay, this is what it's going to look like. I get it. I'm going to kind of pretend this clear little bottle isn't over here. Extremely cost-effective way to advance the conversation was by having that prototype in hand.
So Brian, how did you create on a small budget and limited resources?
Yeah, at this time I essentially had no budget, so I had to get real scrappy. So what I did is I went into the local grocery store and I found similar products that had the desired packaging I want. In our case, 12-ounce sleek can, so like the taller cans. And I grabbed a bunch of them, probably 24, enough to fill a couple cases. And I ended up spray painting the cans white because that's our base color for our brand. Also, I didn't want the other brand to show through when I'm talking with prospective investors or retailers. So spray painted it white. I spent some time on Adobe Photoshop creating labels, custom sized. I measured the circumference of the can, figured out exactly what size I needed, designed those up. And I use a service, Sticker Mule. They create amazing professional looking stickers that actually look like labels. So I ordered a few of those and ended up wrapping each and every can with the four distinct flavors that we have. So I had full sets of each. Just one thing to note is like you just want to make sure that when you're doing this, make sure that it looks as final as possible. So get your FDA regulation documents about labeling. Make sure you read through that and follow it, because you don't want to go into a prototype that an investor goes, hey, I know you can't produce that can because nutrition label's wrong or you don't have a UPC. So just make sure you have all that on the label when you do this.
What I find is you just explain that as if it was a simple process. And I don't mean just the labeling part, but you went to the store, you got your cans, you spray painted each one. It had to dry. You had to design your labels. You had to make sure they fit precisely. And then you had to apply them. What was how long did that actually take for you to go from like, okay, I need to start, and then having a finished can?
It took a couple of weeks to get them to a point where I felt good about them. Another thing that I did that I think took it to another level was I was talking with secondary packaging suppliers. So secondary packaging is like if you buy a 12-pack, it's the cardboard box that's holding it together. Or if you go to Costco and you see cans sitting in a tray that's then shrink wrapped, that's called secondary packaging. So I was talking with some suppliers already, knowing like, hey, I was going to create 12 packs. I was talking with the secondary packager and they provided samples of the 12 packs they could produce. So these are cardboard boxes that they're either white or we use Kraft, and they come with no branding on them at all. These are just sample cases. So then what you can do is you can create either stickers or use rubber stamps, stencils, whatever you want to do, apply your own branding to the box. Now you look like you have what is a market ready product, even though all of it is a prototype. This is extremely cost effective approach to creating something that looks market ready.
And I would add the stencil approach that you used was incredibly time consuming, but amazingly artistic and dead on brand for something that you're creating in your home as something that's as organic as it is.
Well, thank you. Yeah, it took, I was purposely putting a lot of thought and effort into it because I wanted to make sure that I looked as real as possible to whoever I was talking with, which is very important. You got to be buttoned up.
Buttoned up. So now you've got your first iteration of a prototype. What's the process after you've done your first version of them?
You're not done here. I wouldn't go start setting up your meetings yet with retailers or investors. It's important that you iterate. You want to make sure that the messaging on the can, the messaging on the box, I keep saying can, whatever your product is, if yours is a food product or a snack product, it's all synonymous here. But you want to make sure you're taking that prototype packaging and putting it in front of as many people as possible, ideally end consumers, because you want them to pick it up off the shelf. Also, if you can, talk with some retailers because they have to receive the product. You don't want to put your product in packaging that they can't easily break open and put the product on the shelf. They don't want the hassle. They won't buy your product again. So think through these things, put it in front of as many people as possible. When it came to end consumer, one of the things that I would consistently do, and thank you for letting me do this, was come into your bar and sit and talk with customers of yours that I didn't know and just show them what I was working on at the time when it came to can design or samples and just get unfiltered feedback. There's nothing better than a drunk person when it comes to unfiltered. They'll tell you exactly what they're thinking. So it's great. It's just iterate, iterate, iterate. But then at the same time, we talked about this in previous episodes, always keep MVP in your mind, minimum viable product. So you don't want to get stuck here like in the minutiae. You want to make sure that once it's in a good spot and the majority of people are saying, yes, this is inviting, this looks interesting, the packaging is resonating, move forward. You can always iterate later on. Make sure you don't get stuck here. And then just do that a few times. So just, I would say rinse and repeat. Just do it a few times until you feel like you're in a good spot.
I always felt that it always tasted viable and it just keep getting better. And the one thing is I'm very taste sensitive. If something doesn't taste good, I'll never drink it or buy it again. But I would say your beverage started off tasting good. And that's what a great place to begin at. And then to move forward to even a more tasty flavor format.
Yeah. And that goes back to like doing your homework before you even get a formulator involved, before you try to get your process authority letter. You just want to make sure that everything is really buttoned up before you keep advancing. Same thing with packaging. Spend the time. And that's what I was doing here as well. You'll probably see this theme throughout our future podcasts is test, iterate. If you need to, go down a different path. Don't over iterate. Like don't turn your product into something that it isn't because of what consumers are telling you. Like you started your idea for a particular reason. You might want to continue guiding it down the path you originally chose unless there's a very strong reason not to.
And you landed at a place where you had a formulation that you were extremely happy with. You had can labels that you were extremely happy with. It had the information conveying exactly how you wanted to convey it. And so you've got that, your formulation and your labels and your packaging. And it was on to the next step.
An important step here that you should definitely consider doing, involve an FDA attorney at this stage. Even though you don't have what you think is going to be a final product yet, you need to involve them. There's too many FDA regulations that are out there that you probably don't know. Like you don't know if you're making a claim that might be false or you have a statement that's misleading. You can get in a lot of trouble down the line. There's some major beverage brands that have just realized that might have cost $300 million. So you just want to make sure that you're not making misleading statements and do it now. So if you decide to get an FDA attorney involved, there's a couple things that they'll do. They'll ask for an engagement letter and then scope of representation. Don't worry about confidentiality. Like that's going to be baked into these letters. The FDA attorney is not trying to steal your drink, I can promise you. So focus on the scope of representation. In this case, you're looking for compliance with FDA regulation. It changes all the time, but the big change was a couple years ago, they actually changed how nutrition labels are supposed to look, what they're supposed to say. It's minutia, but it's important because you can get in trouble if you don't comply.
Is it going to be extremely expensive, this process, this part of the process?
You can find FDA attorneys that work with startup brands, and they will be a little more affordable. And I say a little more. They're still expensive. You're going to have a retainer that you're going to have to pay for, and then an hourly fee. Like it's not unusual for the retainer to be I would say 1500 to 5000, depending on what your ask of them is. And you get so many hours from that retainer. And then if you exceed it, hourly rates, and those can range from, let's say, 250 on the low end, all the way up to $1,000 if you're talking like with the top attorneys. So budget a few thousand dollars for this effort. Now a quick word from our sponsor. Yep, it's us again. Our mission here at Maka is wheatgrass for all, one can at a time. Your first can is on us. Go to livingmaka.com/making, select your flavor of choice, and check out with the code MAKING2022. Enjoy your free can.
So you didn't have final canned product, but you did have prototypes. How did you and Maka utilize those prototypes moving forward?
There's many ways to use these. And I was using them primarily for building up pre-sales with customers, raising initial capital, and obtaining retailer commitments. On the customer side, you can use the prototypes for imagery on a landing page. If you decide to go down the crowdfunding route, ideally you want to have a can in hand, whatever your product is, in our case, a can in hand for these crowdfunding efforts, because they want to know that, or at least you want to instill confidence that your product is actually going to launch. A vast majority of crowdfunding doesn't launch, also doesn't get funded. So if you can definitely use the prototypes to help you with those efforts. It's also important because when you're talking with friends, families, associates, if they can see it and hold it, ideally desire it because you have some great looking packaging, it will incentivize them to go to your landing page where you can capture contact information for future targeting. So with customers, it's actually important to have these early.
It makes it real, right? You're holding something that's tangible and you're able to visualize it, as you mentioned, online.
Yeah, they can't crack it open, but they can at least hold it.
It starts becoming more and more real once they you know, if you see something in any format, it's all of a sudden they might think it exists. They'll ask you, "Well, can I order it now?" or whatever steps that you've put in place for them to engage with. From a fundraising perspective, what were the steps that you took with that?
I would highly advise not to go into a fundraising pitch with just prototypes. Bring samples as well. Ideally, you talk this over with your formulator ahead of time, and they have the ability to create one-off samples for you. If not, go back and get that. You will want these samples.
When you're doing these pitches, are they in person, or were they Zoom, or was it a combination of both?
Combination of both. Because this was heading into the pandemic, so some were in person, some were virtual only, some were a combination of each. And you can make it work either way. You might not send them your prototypes unless you have a bunch of them, which probably a good mm-hmm. thing to do if you can. But at the investors, they absolutely expect to try your product. So don't send just prototypes. Send prototypes and samples. The way I was doing it, let's say this is an in-person meeting, I was taking out the prototype cans and putting them on the table so they could look at them, see them while we're talking. Leave your samples in the bag. Don't take them out yet. Then you go into your pitch, talk about your product, get them all excited. At some point, they can say, okay, this sounds awesome. I really want to try it. That's when you take the samples out. I had alluded to earlier, ours were not attractive. They were hidden away for a reason. So put each sample bottle next to the associated prototype can, and then let them hold the can while they're tasting it. And this is a highly effective way to create an engaging conversation without having canned finished product. They love it. I can tell you it worked for me very well, and it helped with the initial production funding that we needed. It's important, though, because if you have this prototype and they're sampling it, the next question, be ready for this, is what is the production minimum quantities that you need to hit? So they're essentially trying to figure out how much funding are you needing. Whatever you think it is, double it. However long you think it's going to take, double the time. Just be ready for that conversation because it will come up during when you're presenting your prototypes.
So prototypes and samples alone typically won't get investment. As a brand owner, you've got to have to be buttoned up. It doesn't mean you'll need to be an expert in everything. And I would say, Brian, you always came to me, you were extremely buttoned up. And that was impressive because you'd be in front of investors, potential investors, you'd have the products there. The cans were compelling. The beverages were compelling. And you did know the ins and outs. They would come up with questions on production, and you did have an idea of how much you were producing.
You nailed it on the head. You have to be buttoned up. You have to know the ins and outs of being in CPG, so consumer packaged goods. You need to know a little bit of everything. Like, you don't have to be an expert in everything. That's impossible. And ideally, what you're going to do is eventually build a team that's an expert in particular fields around you. But you definitely have to know the ins and outs of how CPG works. You have to be able to speak to how you're going to get to profitability. If you can't do that, the investor is not going to be interested. It doesn't matter how great your prototype looks. It doesn't matter how great your product tastes. You must also be able to show there's a path to profitability and you're the person that can get it there.
Well done. That's what I would say to that. Yeah. And so the next thing is prospecting retailers, going into stores. And I believe you had commitments before the cans in production were out. What was your methodology for going into retailers?
Very similar methodology as investors. Bring your prototype cans, bring your samples. You must have samples. So particularly with a retailer, put the prototype cans out, give your spiel, keep it short and sweet because category managers don't have a whole lot of time. And then of course the main attraction for them is trying it. There's a lot of, particularly in the natural food channel, there's a lot of retailers that will commit early if they like your product, what you're selling, the attributes, the certifications, all that other stuff. Very similar methodology. What they're really going to focus on, though, is production timelines, the viability of you actually bringing this to market, because they have to clear a space on the shelf, and then continuity in sourcing, because the last thing you want to do is be the brand that they put on shelf and then you're constantly out of stock because you can't actually hit your production and deliver on time. Those are the things that they're going to be digging in for. Prototypes start the conversation. They don't end the conversation. You got to be able to speak to all the other aspects.
And that's something you enabled me to do. We knew the MSRP. We knew their margins at the store. We could tell them and speak to the attributes of the beverage, the specifics of the ingredients. And then, of course, you had made the sell sheets. So it was a compelling presentation when we go in there. And I think it made us look much further down the line than just an individual as yourself who had conceived a beverage. It looked like someone who really knew what they were doing. So I'm always grateful for the fact that you had done so much diligence to get us there.
And my one word of advice for retailers in particular, be real about your production timeline. If you don't know what it is, figure it out before you go in, and then give yourself a buffer. If they're going to make a commitment to you, they have to clear a shelf. They have to clear space. If you can't hit the timeline that you're essentially promising, it causes a lot of headaches. Don't be the person that has them go through all that effort just to never deliver. So just be very real about your production timeline. And then, as you were talking about, you have to know, and we're going to have a deeper discussion on another episode about this. You have to know your costs, your margin requirements, the retailer margin requirements, your MSRP. You don't want to be the brand that goes in early just because you're excited about getting a retailer to say yes. You propose a certain MSRP only to find out after you've deducted trade spends, warehousing, all the other stuff that you're margin negative. Again, another episode for that. But these are all things you need to know before you go in with your prototype.
And then I'll just say one last thing, big shout out to those natural and organic stores that are run by very passionate individuals who care about not only what they stock, what they share, their customers, they're known in the communities. But Brian, you mentioned this, that was an opportunity. They really are focused on local, and they really do give a helping hand to the local entrepreneurs. So we're still very good friends with so many of the stores in the natural and organic segment that gave us our first leg up.
Incredibly thankful for them for sticking their necks out and putting our product on the shelf, because it helped exponentially grow our business. So always take care of those who took the effort to go out of their way to help you. And there's several natural retailers around here that we are extremely grateful for.
You know, every single person along the process from the very beginning to, and what we just talked about, the production facility, they want to see that you're buttoned up. And that's, I would say, time and time again, you know, every time you put something forth, it really did look tight. It really, really was buttoned up.
And I recommend that every brand out there or a future brand do the same, because it will help you. In our next episode, we will be talking about production avenues such as self-production, communal kitchens, and co-manufacturers, the pros and cons of each approach, and why Maka settled on co-manufacturing. That brings us to the end of this episode of Making Maka. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas about our episodes, please send an email to hello@makingmaka.com. If you like what you hear on Making Maka, please share the podcast with friends and family and review us on your preferred listening platform. On behalf of Maka, thank you for joining us on this journey.